May it please the court, my name is Gregory Giometti, registration number 16868. I represent the Auto Owners Insurance Company. We believe that the trial court in this matter committed numerous errors. I'm going to focus on three of them. The first error is that the trial court erred in allowing the Nelsons, the plaintiffs, to argue to the jury that the Sadara notice constituted a suit within the meaning of the policy. We believe that this issue is a matter of law that should have been decided in Auto Owners' favor by way of the directed verdict, motion for directed verdict that Auto Owners made in the middle of the case. And interestingly, in reviewing the Nelsons' brief, they appear to agree that this issue is a matter of law. So the parties appear to be in agreement that whether the Sadara notice was a suit under the circumstances of this case was an issue of law to be decided by the court. Our position is that the trial court just decided this issue incorrectly. The second issue is that the trial court erroneously allowed the plaintiff's rebuttal expert, Mr. Bryant, to testify as an expert in the plaintiff's case in chief, which greatly prejudiced the position of Auto Owners. And third, Auto Owners believes that the trial court committed prejudicial error by giving instructions number 11 and 12 relating to the breach of contract claims for breach of the duty to defend and duty to indemnify by including a fifth element in each of those instructions, which stated that plaintiffs are excused from performing their duties because you find that Auto Owners Insurance Company denied coverage and the basis for denial was erroneous based upon the information available at the time. Before I get to the heart of my argument, I just want to briefly go over the factual chronology because I believe it's important in these circumstances. This case arose out of a construction of a home in Colorado Springs with the Nelsons, the plaintiffs in this case, completed for the Hollies in either January or March of 2004. Auto Owners had issued a CGL policy to the Nelsons, which had a coverage period from November 30th of 2002 through November 30th of 2004. A key element of the CGL policy was that it only provides coverage for damages which occur during the policy period. And the policy period ended approximately 4 years before Auto Owners was even notified of the claim. On February 21st, 2008, the general liability notice of loss was sent to Auto Owners. Then there was a series of correspondence that was exchanged between Auto Owners and the plaintiffs beginning on March 11, 2008, based on a conversation that Mr. Hoig, the adjuster, had with the plaintiffs, the Nelsons, I believe it was the Nelsons' attorney in this matter. Mr. Hoig stated that it was his understanding that the damage to the property had occurred in 2007, which was outside the policy period. And there was a series of correspondence later on in this matter, notably on June 24th, July 1st, and July 30th, 2008, in which Mr. Hoig sought clarification of when the damage had occurred, and he expressed his belief that it was his belief that the damage had occurred in 2007, and the Nelsons never sent any information to correct that. And that's really important in this case because there was a lot of evidence presented at the trial about, you know, cracking began back soon after they moved into the house, and then it developed and progressed and got worse, et cetera, et cetera. But none of that evidence was ever presented to Auto Owners during the course of the claim handling. There was no effort by the Nelsons to correct Mr. Hoig's apprehension or understanding that the damage had occurred in 2007.
Also, when was it that Mr. Smith, I believe the first lawyer, indicated that or clarified that he meant that the harm manifested itself in 2007 versus having actually occurred or originated in 2007?
I believe that was sometime in April or May of 2008. And Mr. Smith's letter said that he thought that Mr. Hoag had misunderstood him, and that it was his impression that Mr. Hoag was misapprehending the difference between the occurrence of damage and the manifestation of damage.
So why isn't Mr. Smith's statement some sort of correction or notice to the insurer that in fact they're claiming an earlier occurrence, even though it may not have manifested until later?
Because there was no further information provided as to what Mr. Smith meant by that.
And did the insurance company conduct further investigation to ascertain whether or not the 2007 date was correct?
Yes, that's what I alluded to earlier, that Mr. Hoag had sent several letters dated June 24th, July 1st, and July 30th to the plaintiff's counsel saying, it's my understanding that the damage occurred in 2007.
But was that the extent of his investigation? He never went out to the property. He never asked for engineering reports for any other
information? No, he did not ask for engineering reports, but he did ask the Nelsons to provide the information. And as the court is aware, when the policy does require the insured to provide information when requested by the insurer. So if the insurance company requests information, the insured has an obligation to provide that information to the insurer so it can facilitate its handling of the claim. So what happened then was after there was no response to these three letters, June 24th, July 1st, and July 30th of 2008, on October 29, 2008, Auto Owners sent its coverage position letter in which it reiterated its earlier understanding that it did not believe that coverage existed because the damage had occurred outside the policy period.
So you're getting into your argument quite a bit, and we may need to get to your legal issues. For instance, you know, when you say that, you know, there was no suit within the meaning of the policy, did you argue either a Sadar notice did not put you on any kind of notice of a possible ADR, or if there was an ADR, it certainly would not have been with your consent that the Nelsons go forward?
I think these arguments really came up for the first time during the course of the litigation. They hadn't been made during the course.
That's right. During the litigation, yes. Did you argue that there was no suit because either it wasn't an ADR proceeding, or if it was, there had been, yes, no consent given by
yes,
auto owners?
We did. We argued that at length, both during, in our response to the Nelson's motion for summary judgment, at the beginning of trial, on the very first day of trial, and then most notably, during the middle of trial in the motion for directed verdict, in the record on appeal beginning on pages 2257 through 2264, these arguments were made at length.
But what was the court's response to the argument that, hey, even if it was an ADR proceeding, we never consented to it?
The court simply just said that this was an issue that was going to be decided by the jury, and that was the position of the trial court throughout the case. And we believe that was erroneous, because if you look at the definition of suit contained in the policy, which we believe is dispositive in this case, suit says it includes a civil proceeding. Well, clearly, there's no civil proceeding here within the ordinary understanding of that term. There was no complaint filed. There was nothing that would constitute a civil proceeding.
Mr. Giamatti, let me interrupt you and just pursue that comment that you just made. The definition of suit then goes on to talk about an arbitration proceeding or any other type of alternative dispute resolution proceeding, and frequently there may be arbitration proceedings when there isn't a lawsuit filed. Isn't that correct?
That is correct.
And so then doesn't that suggest that the term suit in the policy could envision something other than a lawsuit?
Yes, it does. In fact, the definition of suit in the policy includes an arbitration proceeding in which such damages are claimed and to which you must submit and do submit with our consent. Now, this provision applies to circumstances which are frequent in construction defect matters, where the contract between the owner and the contractor include an arbitration provision, so the parties are required to enter into arbitration pursuant to the terms of the construction contract.
Right, but that's not the situation we have here.
No.
On the other hand, though, the policy does use the phrase, the suit includes. So that would seem to suggest that it might encompass more than the two specified alternatives in A and B. Would you agree with that or not?
I don't think I would agree with that, because policies have to be interpreted according to the plain language included in the policy. And so if something else was envisioned, it should have been included in the policy.
Well, I understand that, but we have numerous cases, as I'm sure you are aware, that say that the word includes suggests that there may be other provisions or other terms other than those specified in a particular contract or insurance policy.
Right, but except here, in this particular definition, it says suit means a civil proceeding, and then it says it includes two things. It includes two specific things, which I believe the fact that other things are absent means they are excluded from the definition. That's how I would interpret that.
But even the terminology and any other alternative dispute resolution, I mean, that's a fairly broad statement. Why couldn't that include the CDRA process?
Because I do not believe that if you look at the statutory language and how SIDARA is set up in the statute, what a SIDARA notice is, I don't think any reasonable person who understands the meaning of the term alternative dispute resolution proceeding could reasonably consider that a SIDARA notice would constitute an alternative dispute resolution proceeding. I think as that term is commonly understood by people in the insurance industry, attorneys, everybody who's involved with these types of proceedings, alternative dispute resolution, including courts, which mandate alternative dispute resolution, means mediation or arbitration. That's generally what an alternative dispute resolution is understood to mean. And in any case, in this particular circumstance, this definition includes another element which says, and to which you submit with our consent. And again, there was no consent to the ultimate mediation and arbitration process, which ultimately led to the resolution of the Melson's claim with the Hollies, because auto owners didn't even know about that process.
But given the October 2008 coverage position letter, which could reasonably be construed as denying the claim, what purpose would it have served for the Melson's to seek the consent of the insured? I mean, wouldn't they naturally think, well, of course they're not going to consent. They've already told us that they're not covering this.
But that letter, if the court reads that letter carefully, it does not say it's a denial of coverage. It says, based upon our understanding of the facts as of this time, it does not appear that coverage exists. If you have additional information, please provide it to us. It also says that the remainder of the terms of the policy remain in effect. So the letter is not saying this is an unequivocal denial of coverage, don't ever come back to us again. It says the terms of the policy remain in effect, one of which is that if you are served with a complaint, and in this case there was an arbitration complaint served upon the Melsons, that should have been submitted to auto owners for its consideration. So in sum, just to sum up, I'll reserve a minute for rebuttal. I believe that in this case it was clear and unequivocal that there was no suit within the meaning of the policy. The trial court erred in allowing that issue to go to the jury. A directed verdict should have been entered in auto owner's favor, and that would have also negated any claim for bad faith or statutory violation under 10.3, 11, 1.5, and 1.6. for breach of the duty to defend.
Counsel, you'll have about 38 seconds left for rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Jason Kane, attorney registration number 33660, appearing on behalf of Diane Melson and Gene Melson, doing business as Melson Construction. Given the new authority that's been issued and was provided as supplemental authority, I'm going to focus my time, primarily on the application of CRS Section 13-20-808.
So when was it?
I believe within 7 days. It was last week, I believe. But by both sides, by the way. And what I'm referring to is the TCD case that just recently came out addressing the application of that statute to circumstances somewhat similar to this. The first point I want to make is in regard to that statute, the court actually doesn't even have to address whether or not it applies, and that's because of the conversation you were just having with Mr. Giametti, which is under the policy, the terms of the policy allow for SIDARA to fall within the definition of suit. The definition of suit does encompass or include alternative dispute resolution. Auto Owners has argued it's not a form of alternative dispute resolution, frankly, I haven't heard a reason as to why, but the point being is it is a form of alternative dispute resolution because it provides a procedure for the contractor as well as owners to try to settle the dispute short of litigation. And if there was any question as to whether or not it is, in fact, ADR, one of the supplemental authorities that was provided was the Shaw Construction case that came out on February 2nd, 2012. And in that case, it actually had to do with the statute of limitations and statute of repose, but in that case, it addressed the purpose of SIDARA and its process and specifically stated that the purpose was to facilitate out-of-court resolution. It provided procedures for that purpose.
Mr. King, assuming that we accept that SIDARA can be encompassed within this other alternative dispute resolution, how do you address the second component, which says that, to which you submit without consent? Where does that come from? Where do you prove that there was consent by the insurer?
The notice was sent to the insurance company, the SIDARA notice itself, in June of 2008. And inspection was set up pursuant to that notice in which Mr. Hogue, the adjuster, was invited to attend. In addition, the insurance company was put on notice of the fact that the Nelsons were going to engage an engineer to assist in helping resolve the dispute in accordance with SIDARA. They were going to go out, look at the residents, do the inspection, so on and so forth. Mr. Hogue chose not to attend, but he never told the homeowners, the Nelsons, the contractor, the Nelsons, that they could not attend.
So the lack of an objection equals consent? Silence equals consent?
Consent was the argument at trial.
And did the court say that was a question of fact? What
yes.
did the court say?
Yes, that was submitted to the jury, and the jury had to decide whether or not, under the definition of suit, the requirements in terms of consent and ADR were actually satisfied.
Can a failure to object constitute consent?
Can a failure to object constitute
yes.
I believe so, at least implied consent. And there's no obligation within the policy itself that requires that it be expressed consent or consent that's placed in writing or anything along those lines. Secondly, I would just point out, in regard to the SIDARA notice, there's been some question as to whether or not it functions as the equivalent of a complaint. And again, within the policy itself, there's provisions that support the belief that it is the functional equivalent of complaint. And that provision would be under Section 4, Paragraph 2, C1, where it states that if you receive notices or claims or legal papers or anything along those lines pertaining to the claim or the suit, you're supposed to forward that document on to the insurance company, which is exactly what happened in this case. Presumably, you forward it on so the insurance company then can review that notice and make a determination as to whether or not there's coverage. To the extent the court actually addresses the statute and whether or not it applies to this case, the statute being CRS Section 13-20-808, there's two cases, one the Greystone case that was cited by Auto Owners in its reply, as well as the TCD case that just recently came out. And basically those cases hold that the statute does not apply retroactively. It only applies to causes of action that occur in the future. Those cases are distinguishable in the sense that if you look at footnote 6 in the Greystone case, it specifically states that it is not addressing the procedural elements of the statute, which presumptively could apply retroactively unless there's a contrary intent stated within the statute itself. What we're dealing with in this case is a procedural requirement or procedural element of the statute itself, in the sense that we're focused on the fact that the statute states that a notice of claim may trigger a duty to defend.
Mr. Kane, if your position is correct on that, what is your response to Mr. Giamatti's point that he made in his brief that how could auto owners have applied a statute in 2008 that wasn't promulgated until 2010?
Well, the response is that the duties never changed. The duties that that are encompassed within the statute, at least this procedural duty, was already included within the policy itself, and it's not retrospective in that sense because it doesn't apply a new or impose a new duty on the
insurer. Well, except that the new 2010 statute says expressly that a SIDARA notice of claim satisfies the purpose of notifying an insurer, which was not expressly the law beforehand. Isn't that correct?
May not have been expressly, although may not have been expressly the law, but there is the Compass case that allows you to look to other documents besides an actual complaint in a civil proceeding. It stands for the broad proposition that you can have a functional equivalent. And then you couple that with the fact that within the policy itself, it contemplates alternative dispute resolution, and then you have the provision that states that notices that you receive in conjunction with the suit have to be forwarded on. One could assume at that point in time, auto owners would realize that once they receive that notice of suit, they have an obligation then to review it and determine whether or not there's a duty to defend.
Consistency. Statutes. But it's duty to defend and the language of the policy, what controls?
If the statute doesn't apply retroactively, the policy would control, I think.
Talking about the statute. Let's just say the law is today X, and the suit the policy may be a little bit more restrictive than X, which would prevail.
I think
the statute or the policy.
I think the statute actually prevails in that circumstance. Getting back to my argument, in terms of the fact that this is a procedural element of the statute, procedural elements are typically defined as...
Let's ask about that. The procedural element, the duty to defend is triggered by a certain event.
Right.
If the event has changed, has that not retrospectively changed the duty? Whether it be called the filing of a complaint or the filing of SIDARA, if the duty is triggered by a different event, has that not changed the duty? How can that be procedural?
It's procedural because it's the notice itself is acting to enforce. It's the trigger that's the event, the procedure that the party utilizes to enforce its right under the contract. Its right under the contract is the right to a defense.
That's right, and under their argument, under the prior law, there was no duty to defend. The statute comes along and changes it and says now there's a duty to defend. If they're correct, how can we apply that? How can you consider it to be procedural only?
If in fact the court finds that the contract itself, the insurance contract, does not impose that duty, then it probably could not be applied retroactively, because at that point it would probably be considered retrospective in the sense that it's imposing a new duty to a policy that existed prior to the enactment of the statute.
Thank you, counsel.
In terms of the procedural element, again, the presumption then is it applies retroactively, assuming it is a procedural element of the statute. In that sense, it applies retroactively unless there's some contrary intent expressed within the statute itself. And in this case, the statute actually endorses the application of it, at least the language within the statute itself. Under 1B Roman numeral 4, it specifically states that the purpose of the statute was to guide pending actions interpreting liability insurance policies. This action was obviously pending when the statute was passed in May of 2010, and it also addresses the fact that it applies to policies that have been issued at the time. Now, there's a question of what about the currently in existence provision that's contained in the applicability clause, and that's what the TCD case, as well as the Greystone case, focused on in their effort to determine that the statute did not apply retroactively. They found that the currently in existence actually means that the policy period has to have not expired. It's the Nelson's position that that is, with all due respect to both courts, an erroneous definition of currently in existence for a couple of reasons. First, if you look at the Greystone case and the authority that it relied on for that definition, none of those authorities, the case or the statutes that were cited, focus on the relationship between a policy period and an occurrence policy. The only case that actually does that is the Village Homes case, in which it was stated that occurrence policies don't expire, rather they continue to be in effect despite the fact the policy period has expired, which stands to reason because you can still make claims and obtain coverage under an occurrence policy after the policy period has actually expired. The definition that's been attributed to currently in existence by both those courts actually is more consistent with the claims made policy, where there's a correlation between coverage, the ability to obtain coverage, and the policy period, in the sense that once the policy period ends, you can no longer make a claim on the policy. So the Nelsons would submit that the more appropriate definition for currently in existence would be simply that if you're able to obtain coverage, make a claim on the policy, then the policy is still in existence at that point in time. I briefly have a few more comments. I have a few more minutes left, so I have a few more comments that I'll address. In regard to Instruction 11 and 12, and in particular Paragraph 5, in regard to Paragraph 5, I don't think anyone's argued that it's an inaccurate statement of the law. If you deny a claim, you're limited to the basis of your denial, and you can't raise other defenses. You essentially waive those defenses. What Ottawa is arguing is actually that they didn't deny the claim, and that was a factual issue for the jury to decide. And the Nelsons at trial argued it was a denial. Ottawa argued it wasn't. The jury found that it was a denial, and the reason we know that is because the jury found for the Nelsons under the statutory claim 10-3-1115 and 1116, in which it found or was required to find that there was an unreasonable denial of the payment of the cost of defense. So the jury actually did find there was a denial, and there was support for the support in the record for that finding, in the sense that if you simply look at the claims handling guide of Auto Owners, the language that's provided in the guide for denying coverage is the exact same language that Auto Owners utilized in their October 29th, 2008 correspondence. And Auto Owners is claiming, well, that's irrelevant, but it's actually relevant to determining what the intent was of Auto Owners when they issued that letter. The panel doesn't have any further questions. Thank you.
Just briefly to address the TCD case, that was cited by both parties in their supplemental authorities, and we believe that the TCD case clearly disposes of the issue whether the statute applies retroactively, and it clearly addresses the issue by stating that the new statute applies to all insurance policies currently in existence or issued on or after May 21, 2010. And then it says, a plain reading of currently in existence supports the conclusion that 1320.808 applies only to policies for which the policy period had not yet expired on May 21st, 2010. And we don't see any distinction between that case and this case.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments in this case. The case will stand submitted and opinion will issue in due course. Thank you.